Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know we Zoomed the day before. We're actually Zooming on Wednesday morning. As I go to Zoom, I'm hearing the beginning of the impeachment trial that's starting in the House of Representatives. I will tell you right now, my heart is pounding. As I was hearing this in the background, I'm going, it is happening so swiftly. But the lynch mob acted very swiftly as well. And the moment requires swiftness of action. As you know, we begin our show every day with a bit of political verse from Skip Tenzer. So I'm going to ask Dave to hit it with the music. Monsieur, the music.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
You know, it was always his dream to bring them onto his team. He lied and lied and constantly tried to make white supremacy mainstream.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the work?
So we're going to do something differently today. I'm going to take a point of personal privilege and start with a conversation a little bit about COVID and vaccines. But I want to bring my guest on so that we can even start the conversation as I take this point of personal privilege. I realize that today we have to spend an entire hour talking about impeachment, talking about the Constitution, the 14th Amendment. There are so many things that are now going to be front and center as we approach what to do with Donald Trump, what to do with what happened on January 6th, a day that will live in infamy. And we need to become well-versed in it. We need to understand it so we understand the actions of those that are taking this, for example, this impeachment move, the actions of those that are trying to resist the impeachment move, and what may happen in each individual body, the House and the Senate. We're also going to be hearing some concerns about the use of the 14th Amendment. I think that's important too, not only as it may apply to Donald Trump, but as it does apply to members of the House and Senate. So with that as sort of a background of why the whole hour is going to be devoted to my one and only guest, I want to start with a little bit of aside. I rent this big, beautiful, old 1890 Queen Anne. One of the people that I've rented to for 5 years is the head of the Capital Center for the Arts. She is one of the most remarkable women on the planet. And she posted something yesterday that I want to share with everyone that's in my listening audience. And we know that we're having real problems getting the vaccine out. We're having problems getting the vaccines to states. We're having problems bringing order to who gets the vaccine. And she made a really interesting suggestion because she runs this huge theater. It's the biggest theater north of Boston. And she said, you know what? We're in the business of handling crowds. We're in the business of giving out tickets. We know how to bring order to chaos. Maybe you should start using some of the theaters around the country to help you get this vaccine out. We could have people come online. We could issue them tickets. We could tell them when their ticket is coming up. They could then show up at the different theaters, and we could then make sure that they got their vaccine in a timely and orderly way. What a great use of these empty facilities that know how to manage large groups of people and do it in a safe and orderly manner. I thought it was freaking brilliant. I want to share it with you. I think we should offer this idea in all 50 states. And as we try to be creative in making sure as many people get this vaccine as swiftly as possible, and in the least chaotic manner, take a look at your theaters around the country. Why don't you use them for this? So that's my aside as we go through this incredible pandemic. And now let me introduce my guest. I was looking for someone to talk to me about impeachment. And sure enough, I found Barbara Radnofsky. She wrote A Citizen's Guide to Impeachment. And I want to do a quote from Alexander Hamilton, because impeachment is based upon, quote, those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. That is a quote by Alexander Hamilton. Now, why did I reach out to Barbara Ann Radnofsky? She is a Texas author. She is a teacher. She is an attorney. She is a mediator. She was named the Outstanding Young Lawyer of Texas in 1988. In 2006, which is one of the reasons why I think we were separated at birth, she became the first woman Texas Democratic U.S. Senate nominee in history, and in 2010, the first woman Texas Democratic Attorney General nominee. Not only do we both have law degrees in our background, but we were both first. I was the first female Democratic nominee to be the governor of New Hampshire in 1992. And Barbara, you're from Texas. I've only been to Texas once. And I was in Texas in 1990. And it was because the National Women's Political Caucus picked 50 women in the country they thought should be brought forward to be examined to run for a higher office, be it governor, be it U.S. Senate, be it president. I was one of the 50, all right? And I remember arriving in Texas wearing a jumper with big pockets. And Hattie Babbitt looked at me and said, oh, we got to fix the wardrobe first. But what I thought was really remarkable was Ann Richards was the governor at the time. And I had the opportunity to actually have dinner with Ann Richards. And she was such an incredible inspiration. So I love your state for so many reasons. And now I think I'm going to love your state because of you. So thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
So you wrote a piece at Raw Story, and I grabbed that piece. And it really was an explainer to a large extent of what is impeachment. And you describe it sort of as Congress has a sole power over the process, retaining power after an impeached officer is removed from office, a guide to impeachment. So we saw the first impeachment. It was chaotic. It took somewhat of a long time. This one is going to happen in a day. I think we all have this understanding that somehow impeachment should be a process that requires time and adjudication. If it's going to start this morning and maybe end tonight, please explain to my audience a little bit about the history of impeachment, its use, and why we can go from what we saw the first time around, where it first went to the Judiciary Committee, it went through this whole series of hearings and public discussions, and how it's possible to see that version of impeachment and the version of impeachment that we are seeing today, the day we Zoom.
Thank you. The main issue in impeachment, which is a unique United States invention by the founding fathers and the framers, is that it protects the country from harm. If you start with the assumption that the entire process has no criminal purpose, it has no civil purpose. It's not a criminal or civil process. If you start with the concept that the purpose of impeachment, by the framers' own words, was to protect the country from harm, you will realize how flexible a process it is. It is not chaotic, either when it's really long or when it's really short. What it is a search for a solution to an out-of-control president. And I say president because the founders and framers were really concerned about tyranny. They knew tyranny firsthand. They really did. And what when they met for the Constitutional Convention, they didn't really foresee federal judges as being a big problem. What they foresaw was a one executive, unitary executive, that they were forming. They first called him chief magistrate, then they called him president. They feared the tyranny of a president. They feared an out of control, incapacitated, or corrupt president who would either not be able to do his job or would betray their trust to a foreign power or to those who would corrupt him. That's what they concentrated on. And these men, and they were men
at the National
Convention, these men who knew tyranny firsthand had written the Declaration of Independence, which is basically an impeachment document against King George. They knew impeachment. Many were trained. Many of these men were trained in England, some trained in the United States. They knew how impeachment had been used in Britain, and they did not want it to be a criminal process. So they changed impeachment, and they used the same words, like high crimes and misdemeanors, but the meaning and the purpose of impeachment is to protect the country from harm. They used it in their state constitutions too. So any process in their sole power, the House, and they can change the rules however they want because they have the sole power to impeach, and the Senate, when they get the case, they have the sole power to try the case. And I'm going to repeat, it is not a civil trial process. It is not a criminal trial process. It is a unique U.S. congressional process.
So what you are screaming to me is flexibility, that if it was criminal, it would be more rigid. If it was put into any other of those vessels, then you would be somehow constrained. But the framers understood tyranny. They understood criminal, and they understood this, that they, the two weren't necessarily equatable, that there was a different sort of way of interpreting behavior. And so because of that, they were wanting to make sure that they weren't going to be constrained by those terms, that they wanted to look at this in a way that allowed prudent men to be able to make this decision. But they also didn't want it to be easy, because they give the sole power of impeachment to the House. But then in order to remove that person that has been impeached, you then have to go to the second body. So this is not simple. And you have to have them be able to know.
It's an amazing story of what happened during the Constitutional Convention at the final debate on the impeachment clause. You've got George Mason, you've got James Madison, future president of the country, and they're debating what words to use to describe this innovation, this revolutionary idea of how they have changed what the law of impeachment was in England to an entirely new system. And they're debating, what do we call this new system? Well, at the time, there's an ongoing prosecution in impeachment of the Governor General of India, Hastings. And during the Hastings trial, which is mentioned during the debate, they're talking about an ongoing impeachment trial, these well-educated men, many of them lawyers, many of them involved in impeachments earlier through state conventions. And they are deciding what words to use. They first think, well, we'll talk about impeach for maladministration. And the answer is, that's not a good idea. Then we'd be impeaching them all the time for everything. Then they decided to say, well, let's call it something more. And so that's when they inserted treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors and decided on that language. But when they used the words high crimes and misdemeanors to add, they already had treason and bribery and they didn't think it was sufficient, right? So when they decided to add high crimes and misdemeanors, they understood that it was a term of art, a special phrase that they were going to use to describe maladministration, but limit it to those acts of maladministration where they could prove substantial harm. They chose a phrase to add to treason and bribery, which do require intent, to the language, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors. And through the history of impeachment, and that's really what my book is devoted to, the history of impeachment case by case in the United States. Every one of those cases involved an officer, high civil officer, causing massive harm to the United States, but no intent is required. Indeed, the first impeachment conviction in the United States was a senile federal judge who is incapable of forming intent. And he was convicted. Now, why do we go through this history? Why is it so important to understand, yes, the House and the Senate have amazing sole powers. The House has the sole power to impeach, sending the articles over to the Senate. Those are the charges. The Senate has the sole power to try the case. They don't have to take weeks or months. They can do it in a day if they want. When the Senate uses its sole power to try the case, it can only give two penalties. The first, automatic removal. Automatic removal if they vote to convict on any one article. And the second penalty is the one that I wrote about in the article you read, which is removal from office is automatic. No, removal from office is automatic on the first conviction. The second big penalty is a bar from future federal office holding. And that is done, by the way, by majority vote. The first vote requires 2/3 of the Senate on removal from office.
As we're going right now into the impeachment, as we're actually zooming, they've only decided to have one impeachment charge, which I was a little bit surprised by, which was incitement of insurrection. I thought it was interesting that they chose the term insurrection, because in some ways I feel like it's a bridge. It works in impeachment, but it also works in the 14th Amendment, because I believe
it also works in law. It's a criminal. Let me say that you can also criminally prosecute for insurrection. Impeachment has nothing to do, by the way, with a criminal prosecution. You can do both. Double jeopardy doesn't attach to impeachment.
The question I guess I have for you is, you talked about the House has the sole authority over impeachment and that the Senate has the sole authority over the trial. You can't appeal this. There's no ability to do that. So they control the rules. They control how they approach this. What if the impeachment happens today? It is then Does it have to go immediately over to the Senate, or can they sit on it? Can they wait until the transfer of power so that Mitch McConnell is no longer the majority leader? Are they required to send it over directly? And can the Senate sit on it? Can the Senate sit on it after Donald Trump is no longer president? Because again, the question is, must there be a sitting executive in order for impeachment to be fulfilled? Or can you actually start a process, but end the process, and the person that you're focusing on is no longer president of the United States?
The decision is completely up to the House as to when and whether they send over the articles of impeachment. So the House can wait. The decision in the Senate, once they get the articles of when to hold the trial, is completely within the Senate's discretion. Your specific question has never been tested before, but the has been tested in theory, and here's why. When the House sends the articles over to the Senate and the Senate has a trial and starts to vote, they're given usually a set of articles. In this one, there's one article. But they're given a set of articles historically. And let's say on the first article, they vote guilty. The effect of the guilty conviction, remember, there's no jail, there's no penalties, there's no fines. The effect of the guilty conviction is only one thing, and it happens automatically. And by now, you're an expert. You know what happens when there is a vote of guilt. The automatic result is removal from office. At that point, we're on Article 1, right? At that point, in our theoretical example, the president is removed from office automatically. There is no appeal. That's from a Chief Justice Rehnquist decision, by the way. Now they go to Article 2. They do it every time in impeachment, every time they impeach a federal judge, every time they have impeached a president, they go to the next article. They can bounce around and go to test articles. They did that in the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. When they go to Article 2, they are impeaching an already automatically removed president. Well, we've never removed a president. When they do it in judge cases, they're impeaching whether or not they will put guilt on the second article of impeachment.
So what you are saying is that therefore, if they've already removed him by approving Article 1, he's immediately, he or she, the president, is immediately removed. But there are other articles.
Please use the language. It's not, they don't approve an article. They actually make a finding either of acquittal or conviction or guilt or innocence.
Okay.
They find guilt on Article One.
As soon as they vote for guilt on Article One, the president is removed. But if there are other articles, and in this case, there's only one article, but let's say there were other articles, that means if you want to continue and address the other articles, you are already addressing articles of a removed president. So what I'm hearing from you, if I'm correct, is that therefore, if they decide to impeach, if they decide either to hold the impeachment before they send it over to the Senate, or if the Senate decides to hold it until Donald Trump is gone from office, because of what you were saying about the articles, it then flows from there. You don't need to have a sitting president to basically have a trial on an article of impeachment, in part because you already have an experience where once you vote on Article 1, the person is removed. But if there are other articles, nothing precludes you from voting on those other articles. So you don't necessarily need to have a sitting president in order to impeach. Is that correct?
Yes, but the impact of it is more significant than you realize. You're making a situation where you're thinking about the future. Historically, it happens in high officers and our experience in removal. Let's talk about the cases in the past. So we want to rely on historical precedent. We don't want to just theorize. I want to tell you two things about historical impeachments of federal judges. And they apply, by the way, we know that the law of federal judges being impeached applies to presidents. It used to be debated, but once Lindsey Graham prosecuted President Clinton, then House Representative Manager Prosecutor Lindsey Graham relied on federal cases involving federal judges impeached. And by using that, they established clear precedent. Everyone followed it, and they used the federal judges' cases. And it is the federal judges' cases that I am using, just like Lindsey Graham used, federal judges impeached. And so if you'll go through that scenario, here's what the implications are. When a federal judge is impeached,
they will have multiple federal articles that go to the Senate of impeachment. First, we have the scenario where they vote on all of the articles. They don't have to. In Andrew Johnson's case, they didn't. But when they vote on any one article and it's guilt, once that's confirmed, the officer is removed automatically. There's no debate. All scholars agree on that. When they finish doing those articles, let's say number one is guilty, number two is innocent, number three is guilty. Just assume there's many other articles involved. When they have that, they then must, if they want to disqualify the person from future federal office, keep in mind, you now have a different situation. There have been two guilty findings and they're removed. That person is doubly removed automatically. And here in an entirely different proceeding, they now are going with a really removed judge to an entirely different process about whether to bar them from future office holding. Now, they've gone both ways when they've come to that second issue in judges. Judge Ritter, for example, he was impeached, he was convicted, he was therefore automatically removed. Sometimes they do icing on the cake and they take a vote on removal, but it's not necessary. Then they went to a second vote and they voted not to remove him. They still had what lawyers call jurisdiction over the case. And so these federal judge cases are key. And the future, every time there's a presidential impeachment, as a result of the Lindsey Graham impeachment process against President Clinton, we know those judge cases apply.
All right, we're going to take a break. And then when we come back, I want to ask your opinion about what you think as an advisor, we'll put you on your advisor hat, what you think the House should do, what you think the Senate should do, should they hold it, should they not? Again, refresh everyone's recollection about the fact that it is not an automatic permanent removal. It's an automatic removal, but not a permanent removal from ever running for office again. Once it goes to the Senate, you are found guilty, that therefore you are no longer able to be the president. The point that I thought was really important, it's a bifurcated thing. You have to go back in if you want to make sure that they can never run for office again. And it is a two-step process. A lot of people don't understand that. All right, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We are having an amazing conversation. A Guide to Impeachment by Barbara Radnofsky from Texas. We will be right back. Again, a reminder, we are Zooming actually during the course of the beginning of the impeachment hearings in the United States House of Representatives. My heart is pounding. It'll continue to pound, I think, until this thing gets resolved. We will be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. A fire department's mission is to protect people's lives and property. And in Salt Lake City, Utah, the fire department prioritizes sustainability too.
We want to be part of the solution to our energy crisis and our environmental challenges that we have. We're always looking to minimize the carbon footprint and impact of all our fire facilities.
That's Fire Chief Carl Lieb. He says the city opened two new fire stations in 2018. Each has 300 rooftop solar panels and geothermal heating and cooling. Now the city is installing even more solar panels at one of the stations, with the goal of making it net zero. That means it will produce at least as much energy as it uses.
And the firefighters like being there. It's really a second home for the firefighters. They're there for 48 hours straight. They eat there. They sleep there. And they feel very comfortable in these stations, and they're proud to be occupying these buildings.
The buildings cost more to build than a typical fire station, but they're also far more efficient, with LED lighting, high-performance windows, and folding doors that minimize heat loss. So Leap says the investment will pay off over time in energy savings, and for the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org. Gambling in Havana.
call it a risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this. Ha! I'm the innocent bystander. Somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I'm down on my luck. Yes, I'm down on my luck. Well, I'm down on my luck. All right, send lawyers, guns, and money. Guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money. Hey! Send lawyers, guns and money.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Edit with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we are Zooming actually during the middle of the impeachment hearings going on right now in the House of Representatives, which explains why this entire hour is devoted to Barbara Radovnosky. She is an expert on impeachment. She just wrote a piece at Raw Story, A Guide to Impeachment. Congress has sole power over the process, retaining power after an impeached officer is removed from office. So, Barbara, we've talked a little bit about the history. We talked about the power of the House, the power of the Senate, immediate removal once they find guilt on an article. And then if they want to permanently ensure that that individual never runs for office again, they require a second. Is it a second hearing? Is it a second vote? Can they automatically do it? I mean, I'm sort of curious, when do you bring up par deux? Is it something that you can bring up immediately? Is it something that you can delay? And given that question, it may also inform how you answer. What recommendations would you give to the House and to the Senate? Because right now we know time is of the essence for the purposes of what the House is doing. That necessarily isn't the case when it then goes over to the Senate. We can now then begin to look at what information may be accumulated, what knowledge we have, and there may be some reason why it should not be a slam dunk. Boom, boom, that time may actually be of greater value for what the Senate actually decides to do.
Without being too presumptuous about how the Senate should do their business, let me start by saying the House has the sole power to work on the case and work it up. Once they send it over to the Senate has the sole power. So let's concentrate on the sole power of the Senate. Given that they have this massive sole power, by the way, the word sole is only used twice in the Constitution. Sole power of the House to work up the case and bring the charges, sole power of the Senate to try the case. The Senate's big job is to prove harm. Therefore, my advice to the Senate is to, it's two words, prove harm. Now, I'm a trial lawyer.
I can tell. Keep going. Yeah.
The way you prove harm is through, you can do it through experts, you can do it through fact witnesses, and you can call on the knowledge of the senators themselves. The Senate is the judge and jury of the case. The fact that the Chief Justice may preside, and he's supposed to under the Constitution, the fact that you have a Chief Justice sitting there means nothing. He's a figurehead, unless the Senate decides to let him do things. Therefore, you have to prove harm, but most importantly, you have to educate the public and show to them what the harm is, because the purpose in great part of impeachment is to protect the public. It's to protect our constitutions, surely. It's to protect our democracy and our democratic institutions, and is to protect society as a whole. So if the only job of impeachment, not to criminally or civil punish, they need to prove harm. One great use of it would be to show what happens and what the dangers are, for example, of insurrection, what the dangers are, in other words, the existential threat it poses. And there is no reason not to use historians, experts, former greats in office. You can use any kind of witnesses you want to not only educate the other senators on what the harms are, and some of them need some education on what the harms of insurrection are. And so I make it as simple as that. The notion of how you conduct the trial is entirely up to the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And even though the lynch mob, in some ways, I keep thinking, prove harm, you've got the tape. You have senators hiding under the desks. You have gas masks. But what you're saying is that they have an opportunity not only to sort of prove harm to the very institution that we saw on January 6th, but then there could be an expanded opportunity to say that this is not just harm to what you saw happening at the Capitol. This is actually harm to our society as a whole. This insurrection doesn't just apply to that moment and that day, that it goes far beyond it. Is that what you're suggesting?
Absolutely. Bring it to reality. This is a wonderful opportunity to educate the public. And to answer your other question, which is, do they have to do it right away? No. The Senate has the sole power. And there's a case called Walter Nixon v. U.S. decided by Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist, one of the world's authorities on U.S. impeachment. And what he wrote, basically, was that the word soul really means soul. You cannot appeal an impeachment. It is automatic in terms of removal, and the issue of disqualification is then done separately.
I think the word soul, now it's going to be emblazoned on my brain, because it does mean that they have total control of what it is they're going to do. As I'm listening to you, if there was even any question about whether the fact that Donald Trump is no longer president, whether there could continue to be a trial in the Senate, since they have sole power to make the rules and make the decision, that issue is moot if they decide, no, we don't care whether he's no longer president of the United States. We now have the purview of making the decision to move on this article of impeachment. Am I correct? Because of the word of soul, you can't challenge me. You can't take it to court. Guess what? I decided I can still go forward.
They've got the case. Yep. They've got the jurisdiction. They can do it. And the precedent that has been set in the federal cases is very important. We have precedent where the officer has already been removed by a guilty finding automatically, and they still vote. As a matter of fact, after the first part is done and an officer has already been removed multiple times with multiple guilt findings, they continue to vote in certain cases, entirely separate issue of disqualification.
You've got to write a piece for the Washington Post because you've got to respond to this opinion piece. Because as we come to this, I looked this morning and here is the title of the opinion piece. Once Trump leaves office, the Senate can't hold an impeachment trial. You are saying the exact opposite. You are saying the exact opposite, again, because you focus on that word soul. And I think that that is such a powerful word. I'm begging you to write a piece for the Washington Post, because I think this concept has to be challenged. And we do need to educate the public on, frankly, what has happened, the level of insurrection, how it really sort of undermines our democratic institutions and our society. And we have to actually teach them what the term soul means, because it's such a powerful, powerful word. And I'm really beginning to understand how powerful it is, Barbara.
Let me add that the reason people think that way, the reason they think that the Senate doesn't have this power, is the Senate doesn't always exercise the powers it has. In many cases, an officer resigns, thwarts the entire purpose of the second vote that would happen. But you have officers who resign, federal judges, Richard Nixon, when they see the handwriting on the wall, they know what's going to happen. But in a trial, in any trial process, when someone gives up on liability, all right, and that's essentially the liability phase of the case, when they give up on liability, it doesn't mean necessarily that they don't have to pay damages. Damages in this case that are assessed, there's no money damages, there's no going to jail, there's no fines. There's only two kinds of the damage result that can happen. And that is you're removed from office, which is undignified, all right, but it was never considered a civil or criminal penalty. The disqualification, you're not going to be surprised now about the sole purpose of disqualification, the Senate's sole power to determine how to best protect the country from harm. If James Madison were here, if Mason were here, if Governor Morris were here, all of those who debated impeachment at the convention, there is no question what they would say. If Chief Justice Rehnquist, who wrote the Walter Nixon decision, thank goodness that federal judge decided to appeal these issues. It is the sole power of the Senate to decide how to handle the trial of the case.
Oh God, Barbara. So let me understand what I'm hearing from you too. I'm hearing that you want in part, not only for that the Senate should take some time, that this is an opportunity to educate the public in a way, let's be honest, the public also not only was horrified by what they saw on January 6th, not only do they understand people died, they saw what happened, you see this as really almost a civics lesson that we need to provide to the American people, and therefore to do it swiftly would actually deny the American people a true understanding of what it is that happened and the potential consequences of this insurrection.
Well, with all due respect, that's not what I'm saying exactly. I'm not saying that the Senate should not exercise their judgment about how best to protect the United States. Their mission, their goal, their charge under the Constitution is to protect the United States. And if they believe that what they must do now is act quickly, then I am not stopping them from acting quickly. I'm not. And I'm not arguing that they should be stopped. I'm saying they should sit back and think, how best can they protect the United States? And every citizen out there has a different idea about what it would take. And I am saying that this is the opportunity to explain and give the country a civics lesson and use the free press. The person I'm looking at right now on my screen is the free press. You are the only business protected by the Constitution. And that's it. You are the difference between success and failure. And Sam Dash, when he was chief counsel in the Watergate Senate hearings for the Senate, understood the same thing. A free press and education of the public are what is necessary. And I quote Dash in the book because it is so important. After Watergate, there was this love and thought from Sirica, the judge, and from people like Sam Dash. They thought, this can't happen again. We've got all this understanding and warning and knowledge. We've educated the public. And then what happened 50 years later?
Right.
And now what's happening now, post-Watergate?
So I'm going to read something from your article, because again, I want to get into what you said is that this is that the Senate needs to take pause to understand whether acting swiftly will benefit the public or taking some additional time in order to educate the public in a way that they think is rational and reasonable. And you write, if the Senate convicts by 2/3 vote on any one charge, apparently there's only going to be one, the president is automatically removed. The then removed former president, however, would not be disqualified from future office holding. The penalty of disqualification is not automatic on impeachment conviction. To disqualify an impeached and convicted now former high officer, the Senate needs to undertake a second vote. Without the disqualification vote, which requires only a majority in the Senate, the impeached, convicted, disgraced, removed former high officer may run for office again. The Constitution sets no time limits for the disqualification work. So as I'm listening to you, the Senate actually has two bites at this apple. It could convict and do it swiftly. As you say, they have to think about this. But the decision to disqualify may happen months from now. It doesn't have to happen automatically. And there may be an opportunity here for the value of doing the disqualification vote, I'm just thinking out loud, later, in order to provide even more information to the public at large, so that when, by the majority, they decide to perhaps vote for disqualification, everyone is at least on the same page or understanding why this is a permanent disqualification. And in a way, it's a gift that they have these two things, because one sort of appreciates the rationale right now for swiftness, i.e. what you're seeing happening today as we Zoom in the House of Representatives. And at the same time, it still gives them an opportunity to hold a lot of public hearings, to use the media in order to educate the public about the consequences of this and then vote to disqualify. So they get both the swiftness and they get the time in order to make sure everyone understands what the hell has happened and why we must act.
Yes.
Oh, I love you. You're the best teacher, Barbara. And when thinking about this, again, I'm going to say something about the pandemic that people are going to be offended by. But the pandemic may turn out to be also a gift in this, in that we have time to pay attention. We are not only afraid of what happened on January 6th, we are afraid of dying and illness and seeing our healthcare system, and we're being told to socially distance, and we're being told to isolate, and we're being told not to go anywhere. But that means that we have time to pay attention to the media, time to pay attention to the civics lesson. We have time to finally understand something we never quite grasped about the fragility of our democracy that really requires us to not only exercise the franchise, but to stay vigilant, to stay informed, the power of knowledge. And in an interesting way, the Senate, because of the pandemic, has an opportunity to move swiftly, but also to take some time, because we're in a place where we can see, hear, and learn. And the pandemic is a rare opportunity that has so many of us in a place where we really can sort of focus on this, because our lives feel so constrained by the pandemic.
And I think history will vindicate you in your opinion, because 50 or 100 years from now, just as people look back from now on Watergate, they will see that a pause was taken and that people did learn, and that old and young were forced to do some critical thinking and learn some critical thinking skills in watching the Senate discuss these issues and I believe that this article will end up in the Senate. By the way, during debates, articles can be added or subtracted. This is the sole House power. It's happening just as you and I are speaking.
I know.
Can't tell you what's happening. But assuming they go with this very brilliantly written article, the Senate has the opportunity you're talking about to educate the public. And it is what the post-Watergate analysis said in a very optimistic way, thinking that the public's educated. No, eternal vigilance really is the price of liberty. And we must educate people. My next book is on critical thinking and educating the public based on my teaching of children. Children learn. Children can understand. Children can be taught by doing how to critically think. We can help. All of us adults that are watching this and all of the children that will eventually look at it can understand these basic concepts of avoiding harm and protecting the country.
I'm going to share this with you. My audience has heard this ad nauseum. And that is, I remember going to a bar mitzvah 20 years ago. And this little boy was asked by his rabbi in front of the congregation and his parents, "So what did you learn this year, my son?" And the little boy looked at the rabbi, looked at his parents, and then looked at the congregation and said, "I learned that doing right is hard. When I die, I want that on part of my obituary. It is hard. It requires knowledge. It requires curiosity. It requires vigilance." And I think this is such an incredible opportunity to learn this. And one of the reasons why I think we saw an election, again, that seemed to happen in a way that was less chaotic. Remember how Donald Trump called on 50,000 people to be, you know, election watchers, and there was a fear of violence. The pandemic prevented that from happening. Because what did we see? We saw the expansion of absentee balloting. We saw the expansion of mail-in balloting. We saw in your own state of Texas, the governor expanded early voting by a week. So who was going to show up on election day but the Trump supporters? The pandemic protected the kind of chaos we were expecting to happen on the election. And yet at the same time, the pandemic is also providing us with an opportunity to have the time and to begin to understand that we need to learn. And this is a really powerful opportunity for the Senate to provide us with a really thorough civics lesson, and for the media to be able to mirror that lesson so that we can understand it. Now, before I let you go, we only have a few minutes left. Talk to me about the 14th Amendment. Because my understanding of the 14th Amendment had nothing to do with what I'm hearing about. So explain to me the sections of the 14th Amendment, obviously beginning with the first section, which I think we're all familiar with. But now we're talking about the third section of the 14th Amendment, which is something that may apply to a bunch of U.S. senators and House members.
Well, both the 14th Amendment and federal law punishes insurrection. The 14th Amendment Section 3 says, and it's worth actually listening to, no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of the president or vice president or hold any office civil or military under the U.S. or under any state who, having taken their oath, all right, and there's a lot of language there, or and it includes members of state legislatures, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. They can be reinstated by a vote of 2/3, but they're under a disability from service. It's a Civil War era concept, and there was a law that allowed them to, those folks, to be brought back in. It is one mechanism which some people want to use to disqualify members of the House, the Senate, and all those different areas. Frankly, it, as you can see, it mentions the president as well.
I know.
And so there is this mechanism. Now, how it's used in practice, one of the best ways it could be used in practice, and I get back to the Senate impeachment trial, can be used in the president's Senate impeachment trial as another mechanism by majority vote. It is something that they could use as analogy to what they are doing in impeachment. But as far as what's done in the House and Senate, they have their rules. They can do it. The first impeachment in history ended up as a Senate expulsion.
So all of a sudden, we went through impeachment, we went through the 25th Amendment, and now we're hearing this conversation about the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment doesn't require a 2/3 vote in order for removal. It only requires a majority vote. Why would they even use impeachment if it turns out it's more flexible, the 14th Amendment, for the purposes of removal, because they're not going to have to bring a number of Republicans in the U.S. Senate in order to do this.
Impeachment of a congressperson, which was the subject of the first impeachment in history of Senator Blount, is highly controversial. And it's one of the reasons why Blount is a expulsion and why the impeachment was dismissed. We'll never be able to tell for sure whether it was one of two grounds. One of the grounds was, hey, we're Congress and we're telling you congressmen can't be impeached. No jurisdiction over us. And again, it's unclear because the other question was he'd already been expelled. The Senate had already expelled him. He was gone. Blount is long before the Civil War. He was a Revolutionary Era war person.
I'm looking at an article about the 14th Amendment. And the question was, you answered it sort of, and they said how the 14th Amendment could apply to Trump. Put simply, analysis of the January 6th riot has led many to lay blame on Trump for provoking the mob. Additionally, criticism has been raised against senators and Congress members who supported his actions or acted with him. By this logic, those senators and congressional members could have violated the 14th Amendment as well. If the trial is not successful, could there be a fallback on the 14th Amendment? Is that a possibility? Or could they incorporate the 14th Amendment in the course of the trial? And you said, of course, the sole decider of this is the United States Senate. They can do what they choose to do.
They absolutely could incorporate. In the trial of the case, this is belts and suspenders, but they could absolutely incorporate the 14th Amendment. Now, it is clear under impeachment law that majority is the rule. It's the consensus of all scholars that this second disqualification vote is by majority rule. You don't want to give up that advantage. It's majority rule. And we know that because there have been federal judges who have been disqualified only on a majority. So we know it.
I'm trying to absorb as much as possible. I'm grateful that Nancy Pelosi has appointed Congressman Jamie Raskin to basically lead the trial in the United States Senate. And the reason I'm so grateful that she chose him is that he is one of the most articulate, understandable human beings on the planet. And as you pointed out, this is something that is going to require a lot of thinking on the part of the U.S. Senate about when to take it up, how long to do it. But also we need people who could begin to explain in layman's terms what has happened, the consequences of what has happened, and why it puts us all in peril by the actions of this president. And the decision of Pelosi to choose Jamie Raskin, I think, is a gift. Because I think, again, not only has the pandemic given us time and opportunity, Jamie Raskin is someone that, like you, Barbara, I could sit back and listen to forever because I'm thinking I want to go back to school because I've learned so much. As you look at this moment I'm now going to ask the former politician, Barbara, can we recover in the sense that I'm looking at this grotesque inequality? I'm looking at the challenges of the pandemic. I'm looking at the challenges of climate change. I'm looking at this incredibly divided nation. I'm looking at this huge resentment on the part of a lot of white Americans to the fact that now they have to share the bench with people that don't look like them. They think they own the bench the way they thought they owned the Capitol. And yet they're beginning to understand that, you know, we are a diverse nation. And the only thing that holds us together is not color. It is not ethnicity. It is not religion. It is our values. I am trying to figure out whether we can figure out a way to define what is and what are those common values in order to produce the Velcro that we're going to need to move forward as a country.
I've got great hope. I absolutely have great hope. We've gone through turmoil. We've gone through chaos, intentional chaos created against us. And yet you see what the people of the United States did under the most extreme conditions. With COVID, it was not easy to vote. And yet you had people pouring out to the polls, risking their lives here in Texas, particularly where masking was exempted from the polls by the governor. So you have courageous, wonderful people. We should mention Georgia by way of very specific example. And you have dedicated public servants, Congressman Raskin as an outstanding example, but the other managers are also a diverse, interesting, brilliant group of people. I have faith in them. I have faith in them as prosecutors in this case to put on the case that they feel is needed. It really would be presumptuous of me to tell them how to try the case, but it's not presumptuous of me as a citizen to say, please educate the citizenry, and anyone can access the information nowadays. And so we have advantages that in the Revolutionary Era, in the Civil War, and even at the time of Watergate, where education is much easier. Filtering the good information from the deplorable information is not as easy.
What is so amazing is on Wednesday morning, I was elated. I was elated about what happened in Georgia. I mean, I was crying. I was so excited. And then within hours of that, I was just so overwhelmed with fear and shock. And yet in a lot of ways, it almost, how do I say this? It almost makes sense that a Jew and a Black would win in Georgia as the white supremacists would then attack the Capitol, thinking it's theirs. Because what happened in Georgia proved it's not. It's
and our institutions held, Arnie.
And our institutions,
held. And there were, yes, individuals who did wrong, and they will be, it is clear they will be found, and that there will be the use of our judicial and other systems to prosecute those people. But our major institutions literally prevented what I feel has the look in the last several months of a coup. Not just on Wednesday.
Barbara Radnofsky, you are a gift. Thank you for giving me an hour of your time. The story she posted at Raw Story, Here's What You Need to Know About a Second Trump Impeachment, will be on my Facebook page. I have a feeling you'll be the best of the attitude, so other stations will hear you around the country. But someday I hope to get to Texas and shake your hand. Thank you so much.
Looking forward.
All right, ciao. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Stay well, stay healthy.
You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than 10. Just